Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Well, I've got issues, and in honest, we all have issues. We got them. We put them in corners. We tuck it, you know, underneath the pillow, or sometimes leave it in the closet. But we have them. And Dr. Phil, who will be joining me in a conversation in this episode of the podcast, I'm really excited about having him on. Talk about his new book, We've Got Issues, How You Can Stand Strong for America's Soul and Sanity. Philip McGraw, PhD, we know and love him as Dr. Phil, is the author of 10 New York Times bestsellers. In 2023, after 21 seasons of dominating the genre, Dr. Phil chose to end his daytime platform in order to launch his own broadcast cable television network, Merritt Street Media, which will be popping on the air beginning in about a month. He joins me to discuss his new book. As I've said, we get into faith, religion, personal responsibility, and a whole host of other things that aggravate, inform, and can help us deal with our issues. Coming up next on the Michael Steele Podcast. Hey, everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. Well, I have to tell you, this one is a real special treat for me because I've watched my next guest. I've read his works. I particularly loved his scenes in Tyler Perry movies. Just a big fan. A big fan there. That scene with Madea was just, it's priceless comedy gold. Dr. Phil, welcome to the podcast, my friend.
Thank you so much for having me on. And I got to tell you, there was a lot of Oscar buzz around that Madea movie. I don't know what happened. We were counting on a nomination. It didn't come through.
Well, you know, it's just sometimes people just in the moment, they just don't understand what they see in front of them. So
I guess that's it.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you on to talk about your latest work. Which, you know, really, I think goes to the heart of a lot of the conversations Americans are having today around, you know, questions on who we are, what we believe, why are people behaving the way they're behaving? As my mom used to say, why are people showing their ass that way? And your We've Got Issues really kind of sums it up because we do. We have a lot of issues, a lot of them unresolved. A lot of them we don't want to resolve, and a lot of them we just want to stew in. What was the motivation behind this particular work as you looked out across the landscape and saw how America was evolving?
You know, that's such a great question, and I promise not to ramble because I could talk about that answer for an hour, but, you know, I didn't plan to write a book right now, but I did exactly what you're saying, and that is to kind of look around. And I was really concerned about what I'm seeing happening in America right now. Just real frankly, I see a lot of the values that I think have defined our country kind of getting pushed to the side. I see a lot of people trying to hijack the narrative that defines America. And I want to start out by saying I love this country. Yeah. I absolutely love this country. I stand up when the flag goes by. I put my hand over my heart when they play the national anthem. And I'm really proud to be an American. And I think we're in a real bad place when you get criticized for saying you love your country.
Yeah.
But you're just going to have to criticize me because I do. Is this a perfect country? Of course not. That's why I titled the book, We've Got Issues. We do. But there are things we can, the things we can work on and we should work on. But when I hear people out there that are talking about things that I consider to be terribly counterproductive, things that I consider to be insanity, and I'll give you some examples of exactly what I mean. When I see what I consider to be an attack on the American family, which I think is the backbone of any society, including mm-hmm. ours, then I think it's time to step up and speak up. And, you know, the subtitle of this book is How You Can Stand Strong for America's Soul and Sanity, because this is really a prescriptive book. This is a how-to book. This mm-hmm. is a manual on how to do. I hate people that come along and criticize and don't have a better plan. Anybody can criticize it.
But I live in that world, Dr. Phil. I live in that world.
Yeah, Sam Rayburn, former Texas Speaker of the House, said any jackass can kick down a barn, but it takes a carpenter to build one. Yeah. And I want to be a carpenter. I don't want to just complain about what's going on. And in the book, I talk about 10 principles that I think are critical for the success and survival of any society. And I talk about how they apply and what we need to do. But like, for example, I think that, right now I see what's happening in a lot of the colleges, and I've spoken out about that. I think we're preparing our next generation with this equality of outcome narrative. And let me tell you, that's not how it works.
Mm-hmm.
We got colleges out there that are coddling an entire generation that we're going to turn this country over to. For example, over 70% of colleges use trigger warnings, where they're alerting students to what may be upsetting material. Well, you know what? You don't get that in the real world.
No, you don't.
You don't get somebody that comes into work and says, well, now today there may be some things that upset you, so you can go sit in this room over here. That's not how it works. And here's what bothers me, Michael. When you look at example of trigger warnings, which is a really good example, they don't work. Right. Trigger warnings don't work. In fact, they create the very anxiety
right.
and panic attacks that they're trying to alert students to. And the fact that they don't work is the literature is replete with studies that say they don't work, and the universities that are using them have access to the same research that I do, which says they don't work. So why are they using them when they damn well know they don't work? I'll tell you why, because they're virtue signaling. They're out there trying to say, oh, look how sensitive we are. Look how dialed in we are. Ignore the fact that they don't work, and they talk about trying to get diversity, equity, and inclusion, and they've disallowed use of the SAT. The research is very clear. The SAT is a pole vault for kids in low socioeconomic areas, inner city areas, minority groups. It's the one thing that can pole vault them out of there when they don't have the GPA or they don't have the curriculums to get them out of there. The research is very clear. This is the one thing that will take some of those children out of those areas and put them into the best schools, but they don't use them. And I have research that says, yes, we know that they work, but we don't want to use them because we'll get criticized.
Well, it speaks to the sort of the broader question, because, you know, a lot of the questions I have around some of the things I see happening on college campuses, for example, in the example you just gave, is like, what are you preparing these kids for? I mean, because if you're trying to give them a safe space to operate in, tell me, once they graduate this fine institution, what safe space are they going to find in their homes, their businesses, their community, that they can go chill out and not have anyone bombard them with things that they are hypersensitive to? And I just often wondered, what are we preparing the next generation for? We've pared back how we educate them. We pared back how we socialize them. We've pared back how we arm them rhetorically or otherwise for the challenges of just being alive. And then you couple on top of that, real life things that they have to deal with that we don't want to deal, want to confront, whether it's, you know, how they're perceived and received by police and other authorities in their communities, how banks and business owners work or don't work with them. So you see this, you know, oh, we want to create a safe space, but at the same time, disarm you for actually what you need to confront in the world.
Well, I couldn't have said it better. In fact, I'm going to steal that and use it when you're not around.
you are welcome, sir. Well,
that's very well said, because our job as parents is to prepare our children for the next level of life, right?
Yeah.
And our job as educators is to prepare our students for the next level of their career. And if we aren't teaching them what they need to do to be competitive in the marketplace, then they're going to be coming back saying, what the hell did I pay you all this money for? And here's the hypocrisy of it. You go pay all of this money, $250,000 for an elite education at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford, UCLA, USC, whatever. And then you get in there and they teach you, well, the goal here is we should have a quality of outcome. Well, really? Then why am I paying you $250,000 for this elite education? If I'm going to get the same thing as a guy sitting home in a beanbag eating Cheetos, what the hell am I down here paying you $250,000 for an elite education? And then you teach me we're all going to have the same thing. I think I'll just go get in a beanbag and eat the Cheetos.
Exactly. Exactly. And I can put that $250,000 into something else other than your institution.
And, exactly. And they're getting all this student debt. And, you know, Harvard has $56 billion endowment. And when it comes time to say, oh, we got all this problem with student debt, you notice all of a sudden you can't find those guys with both hands. All of a sudden, what do they have to say about it? Oh, they're not here. They don't have anything to say. They're busy. They're busy administrating. And some of these schools have 3-to-1 administrators per student.
Yep.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, yeah.
How about we get somebody to teach these kids instead of over here administrating? It's ridiculous what's going on.
Well, it's so funny you say. I just had a flashback to when I was lieutenant governor and I had embraced education as a former. I mean, I taught for a short term when I was in the seminary with the Augustinians, and that opened my eyes to a lot of things. So when I became an elected official, I wanted to really get into education. And one of the things I found out very quickly when I looked at our university system is that we had more vice presidents per student. I'm like, what the hell do all these people do? I mean, how many vice presidents have vice presidents? What are you talking about? And then you wonder why even at state institutions, Dr. Phil, tuitions are becoming difficult for families.
And you know what they don't have anymore? They don't have vice president of admissions because they don't use the word admissions office anymore because it might imply that someone is going to be rejected.
Yes.
And they can't use that anymore because that hurts somebody's feelings. So now they call it Office of Enrollment Management. Just like in the justice system, we don't have felons anymore. We have justice-involved individuals.
Right, right.
They can't call them felons anymore. So if your family member gets raped, they weren't victimized by a rapist. They intersected with a justice-involved individual. I kid you not. I'm sitting here looking at myself thinking, did I wake up in the Twilight Zone?
Yes.
We're so sensitive. We got this list of words we can't use. We got this over-inclusive language that we're supposed to use. And I'm not just talking about pronouns. Don't get me started on that, because 30% of fifth and eighth graders cannot read a simple sentence. They don't know what a pronoun is.
Right, right. Right.
I think we should focus on them learning how to read before we start getting into a pronoun. So I'm looking at this thinking somebody needs to step up and say, what happened to common sense? And let's get back to rewarding the things we want to see more of and not rewarding the things we don't want to see more of. And that's my number two principle for a healthy society is number three is don't reward bad behavior.
Yeah.
Don't reward bad behavior or things you don't want to see. Don't support things you don't want to see more of.
Yeah.
I just think that we've lost our way and we've got this, I call it tyranny of the fringe. We got these fringe factions on both sides. You know, on the right, they're out in the woods with rifles, shooting the limbs off trees. On the left, we've got all of these activists that are trying to force an agenda on people that they don't want. And we got all these people in the middle saying, hey, I've always been live and let live. Well, I get that. And I love that people are willing to do that, but there comes a time. My grandmother used to say, "You quit preaching and gone to meddling. Now you start interfering. Now we need to stand up and say something." And these are the things that I'm talking about in the book. I mean, you can't stay silent just so other people will not be upset. They need to get upset. Because we're going to speak up. We're going to start talking common sense and getting back to things that matter.
I think that's such an important inflection point. In fact, I have a speech that I give to national audiences that I asked to appear before and just recently gave a version of it at the Principals First Conference here in Washington a couple of weeks ago, in which I entitled it In Defense of Common Sense. Doing those things your mama told you to do, because guess what? They were the common sense things to do. We've moved away from that in such a dramatic way. You start, in fact, and I was very intrigued, particularly coming out of the political space. So, you know, whenever I see a poll, my antenna go up and I'm like, okay, what are we digging in on here? But you start each chapter of the book with a polling question, and some of those questions include things like, how often do you feel that you're being told the truth by an assigned authority, an unelected government official, such as the head of an agency, or once you haven't formed an opinion about something of importance, how likely are you to revisit that opinion and seek out or seriously consider new information? What did you learn from this type of polling, from the polling that you did? And do you think these questions were important, not just to inform your writing of the book, but for us to understand more fully our own pathologies with respect to the issues?
Well, both, but especially I wanted people to know, here's how I compare to other people. And it's not that there's a right or wrong answer, but let's say I'm going to my Sunday school class on a Sunday morning. And I'm sitting there thinking that I don't feel comfortable speaking up.
Right.
And I worry about criticism if I speak up. If I know that 75% of the other people that were polled also feel that way, then maybe I could go in there and say, hey, guys, I saw this poll in Dr. Phil's book that said 3 out of 4 people are uncomfortable speaking up about something. Is that true? There's 20 people in this room. Do 15 of you feel that way? Because if you do, raise your hand, because I feel pretty alone over here. And if that's true, then maybe a conversation can start and say, yeah. You know, I don't have to worry about being canceled. Someone smarter than me said, I would rather have questions I can't answer than answers I can't question. And right now, that's where we are. We have answers we can't question, because if we raise our hand and say, wait a minute, can I ask some questions about that? Oh, no. All of a sudden, you're a hater. You're some kind
that's
of
what
phone.
Happens.
You're,
yeah.
You can't even ask questions because they say, oh, okay, well, obviously you're a hater. You're not somebody that we want to be around. Well, we ought to be able to ask questions, God forbid, disagree.
Right.
And we've got to be able to have an intelligent conversation. And if you realize that 75% of the people said they agree or strongly agree that they don't feel comfortable speaking up, then maybe you realize, hey, I'm not alone in this. If we all share that and admit it, then maybe we could actually have an intelligent conversation. I think that's important.
I was going to say, just drawing that out a little bit, what for you would be some of the things you like to see us begin to have that intelligent conversation about?
Well, for example, I think it's really important that we get back to recognizing hard work, talent, and contribution, and get away from putting people in situations where they depend on the government to get by. We have too much victimology, victimhood, victim thinking in this country. And I saw it happen in COVID. In COVID, the government spent, and it depends on how you measure it, so people can fact check me on this, but I think they'll find I'm pretty close to the number here, but the government spent $5.5 trillion.
All right, yeah.
During COVID in, putting out bonus payments and extending unemployment and mortgage forgiveness, rent forgiveness, all of this, $5.5 trillion. We found out that $4.4 trillion of that went into savings or checking accounts, which means the people didn't need it for groceries and rent right then, or they wouldn't have tucked it away. If you start taking care of people, if you start paying them not to work, then guess what? They're going to quit working. If you pay somebody more money to sit at home than to work, then psychology has taught me that you're rewarding the wrong behaviors. And what happens, everybody thought when COVID was over, you remember that scene from the movie Grease when it's all over and the doors fly open and they all come running out to the carnival?
Right.
Everybody thought that's what it's going to be like when COVID was over. That's not what happened, because what happened was people got used to not working and their world got smaller and they adjusted to less income and a smaller world. They got by with one car. Maybe they went to a little smaller house or apartment and they adjusted their life to that. And now what they used to take for granted with what they did, whether they were a welder's helper or a nurse or whatever, that looked kind of intimidating to them now because they got out of practice. They got out of the habit.
So for you, that would explain why so many people, in terms of looking at their jobs and looking at the jobs they were doing, decided, I don't need to go back to that. Because I had a couple of buddies who they just stopped work. And I'm just like, well, what you going to do with your your mortgage in 3 months, you know? He was like, it'll work out. I'm like, well, those government, that $1,200 you got, you're not getting that in, forever. But it opened up a spigot for some folks in a way that I think kind of changed the way they looked at their situation.
Yeah, I talk about in the book, we've got issues that part of my training in psychology is in medical psychology or behavioral medicine. And we observe with people that are in rehab, not drug rehab, but they've been injured. They're having to do spinal rehabilitation, relearn certain things if they've been injured on the job, that the longer they stay out, the less likely they are to return to full-time gainful employment. And I mean, it's a straight line correlation that if they're out for 3 months, their likelihood of returning is much higher than if they're out for 9 months, because they adapt to not working. Their peer group becomes patients instead of buddies that they right. worked with, or girlfriends that they go to lunch with at work. Their activities become going to the doctor, going to rehab. Just, I mean, everything changes. They get a new peer group, they get new activities, they get a new orbit that they circle around in, and they don't get up in the morning and take a shower and get dressed and get out. They sit in their pajamas all day. And what happened is we had people staying home, living off of these programs. And then when COVID was over, nobody wanted to go back to work. And then they wondered, well, what happened to the supply chain? Why can't we get these boats unloaded out in the harbor off of Long Beach? Well, they were backed up for miles out there.
Yeah.
And they couldn't get anybody to unload them. They couldn't get anybody to put them on trucks. They couldn't get anybody to drive the trucks. They couldn't get anybody to work at the hotels and in hospitality, because they could make more money at home. Gas was $7 a gallon. They thought, the commute is costing me $200 a week. I can stay home, don't have to pay that. And so you pay people to do the wrong things and then wonder why the country is paralyzed, wonder why we're in inflation, wonder why we have shortages of everything. And I'm watching this and sitting back thinking, are you people crazy? You pay people to not work and then say, I wonder why we can't get anybody to work. Really?
Well, and it's interesting, though, because, at least initially, I don't think it was the idea of paying people not to work. It was like, okay, we'll just pay them to, we'll get through this tough part. But then the second round of it, given all the other observable evidence that was beginning to pile up, like you were just mentioning, you would think that someone would say, do we really want to do that? I mean, it goes to how the society reopened itself too, because even that was ham-handed and not done in a way that was actually encouraging people to better behavior, but actually set up more conflict and consternation, which again sort of fed a mindset that started to form in many respects with how they looked at their jobs and the larger society, and certainly the role the government played in COVID and all of that.
Well, we mismanaged COVID so bad. You could have stopped cars on the highway at random and taken the first 10 people and put them in charge. I think we could have done better. But yet we've paid billions of dollars to these agencies to be ready in these emergencies. And when they shut the schools down for a couple of weeks, I said, I get it. I get it. This is a new virus. We don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
But then when they said, well, we're just going to shut down for the rest of the school year. And then they said, we're not going to open back up in the fall. In a lot of states, I said, I went on the air. I'm not saying this after the fact. I went on the air at the time and said, this is a big mistake, guys. This prolonged quarantine is going to create more damage to these children than the virus ever would. We know real early on that children are not highly susceptible to any serious damage from this virus.
Right.
Well, what about the teachers? Well, first responders are working. Grocery store people are working. Nurses at the hospitals are working. You're saying mask and social distancing. These teachers can work. And if you put these kids on remote learning, particularly in the inner city and particularly in the low socioeconomic, they're going to have such a gap. And when I went out and said all of that, people attacked me.
Oh, you got lit up.
Oh my God. Yeah. And
you got lit up.
Also, You also notice I did not take one step backwards.
No, you didn't.
I doubled down and said, you'd say what you want, but you, and ask me how many people have called since and said, hey, you were right, we were wrong.
Zero.
Although I was right, they were wrong. And what's happened is these kids, the people that did this are the same people that keep records that knew these kids were in the biggest mental health crisis since records have been kept.
Yeah.
The highest levels of anxiety, depression, loneliness, suicidal ideation, and suicidality since records have been kept. That obtained in 09 and 10. And it just kept getting worse until COVID, and then it just really went up. Okay, so what's important for kids like that? You got to keep them involved, keep them engaged, give them an opportunity to achieve, have them interacting with peers, make sure they're out there moving ahead. You can't get ahead if you're not swinging. You got to keep them out there.
Right.
And they yank their support system out from under them. And in addition to that, you've got all of these kids that are subject to abuse and sexual molestation, et cetera, at home. And when you shut those schools down, mandated reporters did not have their eyes on those kids, and referrals to DCFS and Child Protective Services dropped in some instances as much as 50%.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't that the abuse dropped 50%. What we did is we sent them home and locked them up behind closed doors with their abusers, with nobody to run interference for these kids. We right. abandoned them to their abusers.
Right.
And so these kids just got, some of them got their meals, two meals a day from the school, shut that down. They were getting their reinforcement from the school, shut that down. Abusers abused children, molested children. We're getting protection from mandated reporters. Shut that down. Nobody ever talked about that. I did. And they looked at me like I was insane. And now we've got this terrible emotional, social, developmental gap, educational achievement gap, and it hasn't been closed. Some efforts are being made to close it, but not enough.
And what's important about what you just said, Dr. Phil, is that that is demonstrable. I mean, the spike is obvious, and you can track it compared to, a 3-year span prior to COVID and the 3 years of COVID. And then what happened, what we're going through right now, you can actually see what you're talking about, graphically, because it is that stark in terms of how this period impacted this generation of kids and their ability to learn, socialize, and actually, figure out how to be productive members of society. I want to take a quick break. When I come back, I want to chat with you about a very important part of the book as I was reading it, and was really one, I was really interested in the way you dove into religion and the family and the consequences that flow from that. The book is a great one, folks. We've Got Issues, How You Can Stand Strong for America's Soul and Sanity. It is written by none other than Dr. Philip McGraw to be particular about it, but we know and love him as Dr. Phil. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have more with Dr. Phil right after this.
Facepalm America is a show for progressives and others on the left who want to keep up with the ridiculousness that this country dishes out, find out what cable news misses when they're waiting for Trump to appear at a podium, and also, every once in a while, get a laugh at how silly this hot mess of a nation of ours really is. If that's you, listen to Facepalm America. You can go to facepalmamerica.com or find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele Podcast. Great conversation this afternoon with Dr. Phil, who's got a new book, your 10th book, I believe you said. and of course, we were talking before, he says, I wouldn't plan to write another book. But
no, it's too much work.
But it's a good one, folks. It's worth the read. As I told Dr. Phil before we started our conversation, I found myself talking to myself in response to what he'd written in the book. We've got issues how you can stand strong for America's soul and sanity. I was particularly interested in a couple of things and narratives that you were able to create in the book around religion and spirituality, the family, your thinking around why so many Americans have become disillusioned with religion and spirituality. You note, for example, quote, "The decline of religion's influence on society has led to divorce and cohabitation becoming more acceptable. Divorce and cohabitation becoming more acceptable leads to fewer later marriages. Fewer later marriages mean fewer children. Fewer children leads to less organized religion, membership, and attendance. And less organized religion combined with more children of divorce means fewer marriages," and around and around and around we go. And you feed that out quite a bit. What, talk to me a little bit about this disillusionment that you have pegged into with religion and spirituality, and how that has been, an important impact on the family and culturally our grip with dealing with some of the pathologies again that feed this illness that we have, these issues that we have.
Well, it's a big factor in my view, and I don't care, you know, what religion you ascribe to. What I'm talking about is that for the first time in our country's history, religion, people's participation in organized religion has dropped below 50%. For the first time in our 250 plus year history in this country, it's dropped below the 50% mark. And whether you want to think about religion or whether you don't, the statistics are undeniable. And the reason I say that there's a circular pattern there is that we know that if you're involved in organized religion, for example, the birth rate, fertility rate, for those in the childbearing years is 2.1. Mm-hmm. If you're not, it's 1.3. Now, why is that important? Well, in order for us to sustain this country and the infrastructure that makes it work, we have to have a 2.1 birth rate. At 1.3, we don't have enough people coming along to support the infrastructure. I mean, all the Social Security and all the things mm-hmm. that keep this country going, we don't have the people. We also know that the divorce rate is 50% less among people that attend church on a regular basis. Now, I don't know, you can debate why that is, but you can't debate that it is, because that's a fact. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because they don't want to get divorced and be judged. Maybe it's because they find peace in church. Whatever the reason, it's 50% of those that never go through the church doors. And I think there are a couple of things to explain why we've got this drop off. I think there's a lot of competition for people's time and energy now. The birth rate has dropped to 1.6. And the reason most people join church is they want to have their children raised in the church, want to have them christened or baptized. Mm-hmm. So fewer children, fewer people are joining the church. So it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And it's a problem that we're either going to consciously address, or it's going to continue to erode. It's projected to continue down over the next 50 years. And that's going to really hurt our society and hurt our families. I think part of the problem is churches are not adapting. You know, the job of the church is to meet the people where they are. It's not the job of the people to meet the church where they expect them to be. You got to find the people, meet them where they are. I mean, if they're out in the park, then take church to the park.
Yeah.
If they're all watching the NFL on Sunday morning, then you better have church in the afternoon, or you better have it on Saturday afternoon, something. Mm-hmm. You got to meet the people where they are. And because this is an important element of society. And I just think if we'll get the churches to not be so staid in the way they do things and recognize that they've got to meet potential parishioners where they are, and maybe it's changing how you do it for young people or whatever, we've just got to adapt. And but I think it's worth doing because it brings about so many positives for our society. And it, you know, and I'm not just Bible thumping here. If you can come up with some other way that creates those same positive effects on our culture and society, right, Tell me what it is. But we know that organized religion does. And a lot of people are turned off of it because of the hypocrisy of, you know, the Catholic Church and all the scandals that they've had and what people see in some of the other churches as well. But I'm just telling you, it makes a big difference for the family unit and the cohesiveness of the family unit. It makes a difference for things like birth rate and the family staying together. So there are big positives, and everybody involved needs to work on it. You know, consciously choose to be involved, and the churches need to do a better job of reaching out to the people.
How do you manage, Dr. Phil, the intersection of politics and faith, religion, church institutions, particularly as you see, you know, as a Catholic, as a former member of the Augustinian Order, in my years in seminary, you know, I see it and know it from that side of it, as well as from the lay side, and how politics and culture and other things impact the institution and the behavior of the institution itself, particularly as its leaders impact all of that. How do you? Because I agree fundamentally with what you're saying, but then I'm sitting and I'm looking at what I just described in my faith, that I'm seeing in my among my evangelical friends, this rise of Christian nationalism and what that may or may not portend for exactly what you're talking about, where pastors are more driven about the political ideology than the teachings of Jesus himself. When I'm reading in Newsweek, evangelical pastors saying that they no longer want to follow the teachings of Christ because they're too, quote, woke, I'm like, dude, what the hell are you talking about? Okay, I'm not going to church with you on Sunday because I don't want any lightning to strike me. But you see what I'm saying? You've got where I think you could argue at one point, Dr. Phil, that faith and morals and those fundamental things, those common sense things, drove and informed our politics, our culture, how we educated, how we did business. Today, and certainly our politics, but today it seems our politics are driving all those other things. Our affiliation matters more than anything else. You know, my tribe is better than your tribe. And that translates into what church looks like on Sunday morning.
Well, I'm so glad to hear you say that and describe it that way, because politics and religion should be so separate. And
yes,
you know, right now, everybody thinks that Republican conservatives are evangelical, and maybe it's because of the abortion issue or whatever, but they have politicized this. And to me, now, you know, you have the Catholic background. I was born into the Baptist Church and was raised in the Baptist Church. And, you know, they were very conservative, and it was in, you know, Oklahoma and Texas. So you mm-hmm. can imagine that's the buckle of the Bible Belt.
Right.
But, you know, what I learned is that my relationship was with Jesus Christ. My relationship was with our Father God. It wasn't with the church.
Right.
It wasn't with the people running the church. And so the relationship I had was personal. It wasn't with the group. And I didn't care about the group's politics. We just went down there as part of the group, but my relationship was very personal.
Mm-hmm.
And politics, the group think had very little to do with it to this very day. And I had a friend that used to say, I love the Lord, it's Christians I can't stand. And I always thought, you know, you're being a little harsh. We all have flaws, but he was adamant about it. And I always thought, doesn't affect me, because it's a very, I think religion is personal. And
yes.
I don't care what somebody's politics are. And if they get up and start talking politics, I put my earbuds in and I start listening to some good gospel music. You know?
There you go.
But I do think you can find every reason in the world to let somebody come between you and God, you and Jesus Christ, you and your higher power, whatever you choose to call it. And those are excuses. They're not reasons. You still have to have, you got to own your relationship.
Yep.
And that is a one-on-one sort of thing. I really encourage people, and maybe the church you're in is not for you. I had to give a talk one time at our church back when we were living in Dallas the first time. And I always talk to people about, you know, are you being spiritually fed? If you're being spiritually fed, then you're in a good place. If it's spiritually barren for you, if you're not getting addressed spiritually, then you need to ask yourself what you need to do to be spiritually fed. If you can't answer that question, then you need to start looking for somewhere you can. But look to yourself first. It's your job to get along with God. It's not God's job to get along with you. And we've got too much of that attitude today. It's like, it's not the professor's job to get along with the student. It's the student's job to get along with the professor. It's not God's job to get along with you. It's your job to get along with God.
That's right.
And I've always adhered to that. And I think if people would recognize that you create your own experience, right? It's what you make of it. And sure, I saw guys that in the Baptist church when I was 13 years old that were hypocritical as they could be. They'd go outside and smoke between Sunday school and church and use foul language and dirty jokes, talk about getting drunk the night before, all Baptist no-nos,
right,
and then go in and be totally pious. Well, I could use that as an excuse, but that's what it is. It's just an excuse. That has nothing to do with my relationship. And I think people hide behind that sometimes.
Yeah, that is so well put, because that's exactly what happened. As we wind down the conversation, it is that idea that I think permeates your book in sort of dealing with the fact that we have these issues. It really begins with us. It doesn't begin with you coming correct to me. It's how I come correct, how I begin to address those things that are so important.
You know, my principle number one in the book is be who you are on purpose.
Yeah.
Be who you are on purpose. Live with intention. You're not a victim. You create your own experience. Be who you are on purpose. And I'm so glad you brought up the religious thing, because that's where it begins. Your relationship with your higher power is up to you. Be who you are on purpose. Do it on purpose. You don't have to blame somebody else. Whatever you create is up to you. I promise the Lord never moves. He's always there. He's open 24/7.
Dr. Phil, we're going to leave it on that tip right there.
Man, good place to stop.
It'd be a good place to stop. It was such a treat to have you share. I think some important insights. As I said, folks, this is a good book. It is one that I guarantee you, you will talk to yourself out loud when you're reading it, because, you know, I'll say it, you provoke and you dare in a way that makes for a good, healthy challenge. But I think, to the last point you were making, a lot of us don't want to because it requires us to confront ourselves first. It's easy to go after Dr. Phil, and I can put all my baggage on Dr. Phil, and he's going to look at me like I'm crazy, because he's like, well, that ain't my issue. That's your issue. Yeah.
But, you know, this book is meant to unify. It's meant to get people to look to themselves and help close the divide. But it begins with the individual, and then the collective personality of the family, the community, the state, the nation. And that's what I wrote it for. And I think we can create our own destiny going forward. So I thank you for taking the time to talk to me about it, Mike.
Absolutely.
It means an awful lot.
No, it means a lot to me, sir. And I've always been a fan and followed your work. Love the show and all the stuff that you've done publicly and the conversations you've had, because at every turn, you've always made us think. And this book, even though it was not planned, it's here for a reason and has a purpose. And I would encourage everyone, pick up a copy of We Got Issues, How You Can Stand Strong for America's Soul and Sanity. The author is Dr. Phil C. McGraw. We know and love him as Dr. Phil. Thanks again for being on the podcast, my friend.
Well, I appreciate it. And the book is going to be the kind of blueprint for the new network that I'm launching on April 2nd called Merritt Street Media. And you'll be able to find it everywhere you get a TV signal, cable, streamers, fast
awesome.
Channels, terrestrial, 24/7 network. Beginning on April 2nd. So I hope everybody will tune in to be Dr. Phil Primetime, and we'll have news every day and a whole lot of other things. So Merritt Street Media.
Well, you have your folks when that's all set and ready to go, send me some, you know, links. I'll put it all over my social media and broadcast it along with the book itself, as we will from this interview, but certainly since that's just a few weeks away, it's good, a good window to get all that done. So happy to help there as well. All right, folks.
Thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you, Doc. Absolutely appreciate it. That does it for our time together, folks. You know what I always say, do the download thing. It makes me feel all yummy inside. I appreciate it. Don't forget to check us out. You can check out Dr. Phil on Twitter, X, at Dr. Phil. And certainly give us a little bit of love to at Michael Steele and at Steele_podcast. Until next time, be safe, be well, God bless.
Is it just me, or have we all lost our minds? It's a question more and more people are asking themselves, afraid to admit they already know the answer. It's also a podcast, one about people coming together in a time of division and uncertainty to talk about culture and politics, compromise and connections. It's about challenging the norms we've come to accept as a society and working together to find common ground. Fierce and Unfiltered, host Jennifer Horn is a former Republican strategist and party leader turned independent sanity activist. One way or another, we've all lost our minds. Join Jennifer Horn in the search to find them again.